Hello and welcome to the Deathcast, the place where the cool, creepy, and kooky kids come to learn about their true crime. I am your host, best-selling author and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take another deep dive look at a case. This time around, we're going to be looking at a case that was requested by a big-time fan of the show, Jennifer. That would be the Long Island serial killer, or Gilgo Beach serial killer case. Before we get into it, I have the normal show notes and a couple of new announcements. First off, if you'd like to join the coffee club, just go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast. You're interested in getting any of the show's merchandise, mostly nifty-looking t-shirts, you can go to tinyurl.com/dcastpodmerch. If you want to follow the show on social media, just search for The Deathcast or The Deathcast Podcast. I am on most social media platforms and am very interactive. You can also submit show requests through there, or you can go to the show's email at ian@corpsecreekpublishing.com. Drop me a line. Give me your thoughts on what I'm doing case-wise, or suggest one. Now, lastly, I've been teasing this for a couple of weeks now. Big show news. I have officially signed the Deathcast to an exclusive contract with the largest European podcasting agency. Basically, what that means for the show is it's going to allow me to grow the show to reach more people, but it's also going to help me to bring in revenue so I can do things like upgrade the audio, have more time to research these cases that I'm doing for you so that I can present them as complete as possible, and possibly move to doing some kind of video podcast on YouTube. And that's something that a lot of people have asked me to do. Unfortunately, it's not something that I have the time or the finances to do. I'm running off of a almost 20-year-old computer and a $60 microphone at this point because that's what finances are. And this exclusive contract is going to help me to move beyond that so I can give you guys, the listeners, a better show. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, and you get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. The Gilgo Beach serial killer is a case I first heard about years ago when bodies started being found. And I followed it for quite a bit, although, as with most cases from the early to mid-2000s, I got out of following it as other more interesting cases came up. And I'm going to attempt to do a comprehensive look at this case. If I forget something, or I happen to get something wrong, i.e. I give information and there is newer, better information that contradicts that, please don't hesitate to reach out and let me know. We're going to start with a brief description of where Gilgo Beach is. It is also known as the South Shore, and it pretty much runs the coast of Long Island on the Atlantic Ocean. And it's made up of various communities, including the Hamptons, Amityville, Bayshore, Belport, Lido Beach, Islip Terrace, Lindenhurst, Long Beach, Rockville Center. There's quite a bit of money in this area. And that's not to say that the entire area is, you know, a rich man's paradise, but there is a lot of money in this area. And the case really begins, as far as law enforcement were concerned, with a phone call that they received in the early morning hours of May 1st, 2010 from a 23-year-old escort from New Jersey, specifically Jersey City, by the name of Shannon Gilbert. Now, Shannon offered her services through Craigslist, which, for anyone who will remember this period of time as far as the internet goes, places like Craigslist were really the Wild West when it came to what types of services or goods could be purchased through them. It wasn't until a few years later that these sites started cracking down on sex workers offering their services through Craigslist and other sites. So this is how Shannon was able to get her clientele. And some of this information that I'm going to be sharing with you comes from GilgoCase.com. We're going to go over a timeline of May 1st when everything with Shannon went down. One thing I want to stress here is that this is the information as it's known to the public. There may be further information that has not as of yet been released by the police. Between 12 and 12:20 a.m. in the morning hours of May 1st, Shannon met with a client in Midtown Manhattan. There really isn't a lot of information concerning this, although I believe it was more likely than not that this was a regular client of hers and it was really just a quick hookup. At 12:20, Shannon contacts her driver, an individual by the name of Michael Park, and she speaks to him for an estimated 3 minutes and lets her know that she is done with this client, which gives us some kind of idea as to what the business transaction between Shannon and this individual was. At 12:23 a.m., Shannon calls Pack again. We don't have specifics on what the conversation was about, but it lasted for 2 minutes. At 12:25 a.m., Shannon again calls Pack. This call lasted for 1 minute. At 1 a.m., Shannon and Michael Pack leave Midtown Manhattan and head toward the Oak Beach Association, which is a gated community filled with some fairly well-to-do individuals. Shannon had an appointment booked to attend a party being hosted by Joseph Brewer. And it seems as though Shannon was to be that evening's entertainment. At 2 a.m., Shannon and her driver arrive at Brewer's residence, while Pack remained outside in the SUV. Again, this information is coming from GilgoCase.com if you want to check the accuracy or find out any other information that I may not be mentioning here. Between 2 a.m. and 2:30, Shannon and Brewer left Brewer's home for approximately 15 minutes inside of Brewer's vehicle. Again, it's not stated what they were doing, but I have a feeling that there was some form of sexual intercourse taking place, or possibly they were discussing the things that Shannon might do for those who are attending the party before they drive back. At 2:55 a.m., Shannon contacts a CVS pharmacy in West Islip. And a few minutes after that, at 2:57, she calls Pack, and this phone call lasts approximately 3 minutes. Up to this point, it does not seem as though anything is going awry. It seems to be a pretty standard job for Shannon. So this brings us to 3 o'clock, and over the next 15 minutes, there is at least 4 more phone calls, both from Shannon to Pack, as well as from Pack to Shannon. Then the lines kind of go quiet until 4:09 a.m., where Shannon calls Pack again. I want to stress, at least to the best of my knowledge, what I've been able to discover, we don't know what Shannon and Pack discussed, although more likely than not, I suspect she was touching base with him as kind of a safety net, and he would be touching base back with her to make sure everything is going well inside of this home. Now, at 4:45 a.m., at least according to Brewer, Shannon becomes agitated, although the reasons for her agitation are unknown, and it gets to a point where Brewer actually contacts Pack and asks him to remove Shannon from the home. And during this interaction, Pack goes into the home, and Shannon states, "You guys are trying to kill me." The two men continue to try and get Shannon to leave the house, and she refuses. At 4:51 a.m., Shannon makes a phone call to the police, which lasts until 5:14. That's a 23-minute phone call. She calls 911. Some sources state that Shannon initially was connected to the local police department before being transferred to the New York State Police, as opposed to the Suffolk County Police Department. Now, in 2020, this phone call was released by the police to the family, and eventually it makes its way to the public, and I am going to play part of this phone call at this point.
State Police, Trooper Fry. Police.
Yeah, there's somebody after me.
I'm sorry?
There's somebody after me.
Where are you?
There's somebody after me.
Okay, where are you?
There's somebody after me.
Where are you, ma'am?
I don't know.
Are you driving right now?
No, I'm inside the house.
I'm sorry?
I'm inside the house.
What house?
I don't know. Can you check where I am?
I'm sorry?
You trace where I am?
No, I can't. What's your callback number you're calling from?
Huh?
What phone number are you calling from?
Somebody's after me. Please.
Are you in Suffolk County or Nassau County?
I'm in Long Island.
Where on Long Island are you?
Okay,
No, stop, no.
Where in Long Island are you? In Suffolk County? Nassau County?
Huh? Why? Why are you calling me by my name? Why?
County, you on the line?
Stop. Please. Stop it, please. Please, stop. Please, can you shut the door?
No, time to go.
Please. Please. Please.
Go that way, please.
Come on, please. Why?
You can hear during that phone call, Shannon is at times coherent and at other times does not seem to be exactly with it. I suspect, although I don't know for certain, that she probably imbibed of some type of narcotics that evening. You can also hear Pack as well as the homeowner, attempting to coax her to leave the house, especially towards the end portion of that phone call. And there is more to this phone call. I'm not going to play the entire thing. I just wanted to give you an idea of it. There are other phone calls that I am going to be playing throughout this particular portion of the case. And you can hear how Shannon's agitation escalates. After being unable to coax Shannon from the house, Pack eventually goes back outside to the SUV to wait. And around 4:45 a.m., he sees Shannon run from the house. She runs down the street to a neighbor's home, the neighbor being a man by the name of Gus Coletti. And Shannon begins to knock on his door. When Coletti opens the door, Shannon asks him for help. Coletti invites her inside. She keeps screaming, demanding he help her. And at this point, Coletti contacts law enforcement. Portion of the call right there is actually when Shannon runs from the house at 4:55 a.m. to Coletti's home, and she kept her phone on her long enough to record her interaction with Gus Coletti. At this point, Shannon took off into the night, leaving Gus Coletti confused, at which point he in fact calls the police. Shannon's phone call actually ends at this point, and she makes her way further down the road, roughly 0.2 miles to, at 43 The Bayou, which prompts another 911 call. Here is Gus Coletti's phone call to the state police.
Traffic police, 873, what's the location of the emergency?
Yes, I live at Oak Beach in the Association. There's a young girl about 14 years old running around here screaming, and there's some guy trying to follow her.
What's the address here?
I'm at 17 The Fairway.
All right, you have a description of the girl or the boy?
Pardon me?
You have a description of the girl or the boy?
The girl is about 14 years old, got blonde hair, very small. The boy, I can't tell, he was into like a Suburban.
What color?
Black.
So you can hear from this homeowner, Gus Coletti, he's under the impression that Shannon is about 14 years old, and he sees Michael Pack following her. Now, while he's on the phone, Shannon makes her way about 0.2 miles down the road to 43 The Bayou, where this homeowner, Barbara Brennan, calls the police. This is at 5:30 a.m.
Suffolk Police, 875. What is the location of your emergency?
43 The Bayou. Some woman is knocking at my door.
What town are you in?
Oak Beach Association.
What's the nearest corner street, though?
Ocean Parkway. She says she's in danger.
Do you know her or no?
No, I don't. I'm not letting her in.
She's banging on your door now?
Yes.
Did she say what kind of danger?
No.
Oh.
And we live in a gated community.
What's your name, ma'am?
Barbara Brennan.
And was there a name to that community?
Oak Beach Association.
Oak Beach Association.
And I have an elderly mother here.
All right, I'll get somebody right over there, okay?
Okay.
At 5:40 a.m., the Suffolk County Police arrive at the Oak Beach Association. You're going to see different sources giving times for this. Some state 5:40, others stating that they arrived between 6 a.m. and 6:10 p.m., which is a pretty significant gap in time, 20 to 30 minute difference. They cannot find any evidence at this point of Shannon Gilbert, nor can they find Michael Pack, as Michael Pack gave up trying to track her down and by his own admission was driving home at this point. A couple of pieces of information from this roughly 1 hour-ish period. After calling 911, Pack did in fact approach Coletti's home and spoke with the homeowner briefly, and it stated that Pack saw Shannon hiding behind Coletti's boat, at which point she took off. The police did a tentative search of the area, although unfortunately they really didn't find anything, and they would eventually leave. And no one really spoke about Shannon again. We're going to look at who Shannon Gilbert was quickly. Shannon Maria Gilbert was born on October 24th, 1986 in Ellenville, New York. She was the eldest of four sisters. And from what I could see, she had a very troubled upbringing, with both physical and mental abuse having taken place while she was growing up. This eventually led Shannon to begin experimenting with drugs and alcohol, and also led to her spending some considerable amount of time inside of the foster care system. By the time Shannon had graduated from high school, at least according to the reports that I had read, her intake of both drugs and alcohol was beginning to escalate, and eventually she moves out of her parents' home and moves to Jersey City, where she begins working for an escort service called Lace Party Girls. It was an escort service in name only, really. It was a prostitution ring, and while at this prostitution ring, she ends up meeting an individual by the name of Alex Diaz, who works as one of the drivers slash body girl guards for the girls, and Alex and Shannon begin dating. Eventually, the police get wind of this prostitution ring, and they conduct a sting operation on it, which leads to Shannon getting arrested and brings with it all kinds of legal troubles. Now, according to Diaz, the two of them had had a fairly decent relationship, with Shannon moving in with Diaz and his father in an apartment in Jersey City. Eventually, though, Shannon's intake of drugs and alcohol really begins to escalate, and he notices some very extreme mood swings in her. So much so that the two of them would fight quite a bit. At one point, they had a fight, and Diaz ended up punching Shannon in the face, which required hospitalization along with surgery to install a piece of steel into her jaw, which I'm certain led to further drug usage. We will get back to this in just a moment.
Cobra Killer, gay porn, Murder and the Manhunt to Bring the Killers to Justice by Andrew E. Stoner and Peter A. Conway is the first and most detailed account of the gay porn murder that shocked a nation. Cobra Killer, featured on NBC's Snapped Killer Couples, pulls back the glitzy veil of the gay porn industry to expose a story of deceit, greed, and the ultimate betrayal. Cobra Killer, Gay Porn, Murder, and the Manhunt to Bring the Killers to Justice tells the story of online gay porn entrepreneur Brian Kosis, whose brutal near-decapitation on a Wednesday in early 2007 sent shockwaves through the small Pennsylvania town where he ran his porn empire. The basis for the Christian Slater film King Cobra, Cobra Killer has been called an addictive page-turner that you won't want to put down by the San Diego LGBT Weekly, and a grisly, gripping documentary account of the 2007 murder by Passport Magazine. Cobra Killer, Gay Porn, Murder, and the Manhunt to Bring the Killers to Justice by Andrew E. Stoner and Peter A. Conway. Available on Amazon in paperback and ebook, or at bookstores nationwide.
We are back. I have a fresh cup of coffee. We left off, we were talking about Shannon Gilbert and her relationship with Alex Diaz, how her drug usage had begun to escalate. And this next part, I'm not a doctor, I don't play one on TV, but I've had a lot of experience with addicts. A lot of places you'll look, you'll see information stating that at some point Shannon was diagnosed as having bipolar disorder, and this is given as a reason for her erratic mood swings. I'm calling bullshit on that one for a number of reasons. First and foremost, no one has ever presented anything to back this claim up that she was bipolar, and by that mean I mean an actual doctor's diagnosis. They just throw it out there. The reason I call bullshit is oftentimes when an addict is in the midst of using, as their usage progresses, their personality changes drastically and you get erratic mood swings. Perfect example of that would be Roy Radin, if you'll recall that case. As his addiction to cocaine worsened, he began having extremely erratic mood swings, going from nice and jovial to violent outbursts. And it seems that Shannon was having a very similar situation, and this is just my opinion. I believe that she more likely than not threw out this whole idea of having bipolar as an excuse for the mood swings that she was having due to her drug usage. It is known that she had at least one further arrest after the prostitution ring was busted by the police, this again for solicitation. By 2010, Shannon and Alex Diaz had moved into their own apartment in Jersey City, and Shannon had begun working as an independent, offering her services on places like Craigslist and Backpage, and she did this with the help of another man that she had met through the Lace Party Girls prostitution ring, that being 41-year-old Michael Pack. Now, Michael Pack was a fairly large Asian man from, I believe it was the Bronx, although I could be mistaken. I'm recalling this piece of information off the top of my head as it's not in my notes. Anyway, Pack is working with Shannon, and this is how they end up going out to Gilgo Beach. Now, I've already discussed what took place on the night that Shannon disappeared. When she did not come home after a day or two, Alex Diaz gets concerned and reaches out to Joseph Brewer. Joseph Brewer was an out-of-work financial expert who was recently either separated or divorced from his wife. Some sources state that numerous neighbors said that in the months leading up to the incident with Shannon, they had noticed an unusual amount of prostitutes coming in and out of his home, and that they believe he had begun to take the bachelor lifestyle to its excess. Well, Diaz reaches out to Brewer, and Brewer basically tells him that Shannon had been there. He had not, in fact, hired her as a prostitute, and that the reason she flipped out, and this particular piece of information is coming from one source, Brewer states that he accused Shannon of being a man, and this is what really led to her losing her mind. Eventually, Diaz decides to go out to Oak Beach, and he meets up with Brewer. And the two of them go and try and retrace Shannon's steps, going so far as to head to the Suffolk County Police Department, where Diaz attempts to place a missing persons report on Shannon. Obviously, because Shannon is A, a full-grown adult, and B, working as a prostitute, the police kind of brush him off and tell him to go home, and that if Shannon isn't at their apartment by the time he gets home, that he should place a missing persons report with the Jersey City Police Department. While that bit of information is odd, it is not unfounded in cases concerning prostitutes, as oftentimes, unfortunately, as we've discussed, the police look at women who work as prostitutes as being secondary citizens who aren't worth the time or the effort that will be required for them to look into where they have gone. On May 3rd, Shannon's mother receives a phone call at her home in New York from a doctor who claims that he runs a halfway house for young girls who are living on the streets. This doctor, Peter Hewitt, states that he had treated Shannon 2 days prior when she showed up at his home in a panic and had given her some type of drug, although he wouldn't say what that drug was. This doctor stated that the drug he gave her was to get Shannon to calm down. He also states that after Shannon calmed down, she had left his home and gotten into a black SUV driven by an Asian man, and that he had not seen her since. Why he decided to call Shannon's mother, Marie, I am unaware. I don't believe he ever stated the reasons for that. But Shannon's mother finds the man off and decides to question him, asking how he got her phone number. This Dr. Hewitt states that he got the phone number from Shannon as, in order to treat people, he requires that they give him an emergency contact number. After which, the two of them get off the phone. Naturally, Shannon's mother contacts Diaz, who states that, yes, Shannon is in fact missing. And eventually, Shannon's family puts in a missing persons report with the police department in Jersey City. Why they didn't put it in with Suffolk County, I don't know. That still does not make any sense to me, because she went missing in Suffolk County, but that's besides the point. And a week later, on May 9th, Shannon's family heads out to Oak Beach and begins putting up flyers with pictures of Shannon on it, listing her as a missing person. According to Marie Gilbert, it was during this time that she encountered a man whose voice she instantly recognized as being the man who had called her home, that being Dr. Hewitt. When she presses the man on the fact that he made this phone call, Hewitt denies ever having made it, and in fact would later state that that was the first time he had ever encountered Mrs. Gilbert, although we know for a fact that this is untrue, as later he would admit on national television that he had made that phone call as well as another one. Shannon's case kind of
goes on the back burner, but eventually her family is able to convince the police to look into her disappearance, and it's during this period of time, roughly a month after Shannon went missing, that the Suffolk County Police are able to link the frantic 911 call that they received on May 3rd to this missing woman, and they begin to search the area. They sent out a detective from the Suffolk County Police Department by the name of Malia, who had been on the department for 31 years at this point, and in fact had a canine unit with him who was used to search for bodies. Now, Detective Malia would routinely return to the area where it was believed that Shannon had disappeared over the next 6 months, finding nothing each time. That is until the morning of December 10th, when Officer Malia and his canine unit went out to Gilgo Beach, specifically the Ocean Parkway. According to Malia, he had recently read that the FBI stated that oftentimes when an individual is killed, they will be left within feet of the road. So, with this information fresh in his mind, Officer Malia and his dog, Blue, begin searching along Ocean Highway, and they do end up finding something. That afternoon, as they're searching along the road, the dog begins to react, giving the telltale signs that it has picked up the scent of a decomposing or dead body. Obviously, Officer Malia follows the dog, which makes its way off the road and into the marshy area, at which point they discover a burlap sack. And inside of this burlap sack, Officer Malia is disgusted to find the skeletalized remains of a human body. Obviously, Officer Malia contacts others at the Suffolk County Police Department. They get a crime scene investigation unit out there to not only retrieve the body, but lock down the area where it was found and to look around to see if they can find any evidence. Over the next few days, police continue to comb the area where this body inside of the burlap sack was found, and amazingly, they make another discovery. On December 13th, they find three more sets of skeletal remains close to near where this first body was found, all of them inside of burlap sacks. Most sources state that the bodies were each found within 500 feet of one another. So now the police don't just have one individual they're looking for, Shannon Gilbert, they have four sets of remains that they need to try and identify. Obviously, this makes the news and people are beyond intrigued. Now, the police continue looking around. They end up on the 15th seizing a white SUV from the home of Shannon Gilbert's client on the night of her disappearance. Also on that date, the 15th of December, the police announced that the FBI has offered to assist in working on this case, although whether or not the police took them up at this point in time, I'm not exactly clear on. I know eventually the FBI does become involved. I suspect the police more likely than not did take the FBI up on their offer at this point. The following day, the Suffolk County Medical Examiner's Office announces that all four of the victims found are females, but that none of them are, in fact, the remains of Shannon Gilbert. The medical examiner's office also states during a press conference that they are using DNA, dental records, and facial reconstruction in an effort to try and identify the victim's remains. On January 19th, 2011, the medical examiner's office announces that it has been able to identify one of the bodies as belonging to Megan Waterman. Megan Waterman was 22 years old and was from South Portland, Maine. She had gone missing on June 6th of 2010 after an ad advertising her services was placed on Craigslist. And according to multiple sources, and I want to make this clear about this case, Megan Waterman was not willfully working as a prostitute. In fact, all of the sources I have read state that her boyfriend at the time, who was a 20-year-old man, had in fact forced Waterman into working as a prostitute, and that he had in fact brought Megan down to New York on the weekend of June 6th with the express purpose of forcing her to work as a prostitute. They were staying at a motel in Hauppauge, New York, about 15 miles northeast of Gilgo Beach. An interesting bit of news from this period of time: when the four bodies were initially discovered, this group of young women who would become known as the Gilgo Four, the police already suspected that there was a serial killer at work in the area. And the news media had picked up on this, although unfortunately it really wasn't getting a lot of national or even local attention. And I say that because I did live in New Jersey during that period of time, and it was not on the news. It may have been on local news or more in New York City-centric markets, but even the area I lived in was considered a New York City market, so it wasn't getting in a whole lot of press coverage. You're going to see that's going to pick up, but I just found it really interesting that you have both the media and the police believing that there is a serial killer on the loose in this area, has been using this area as a dumping ground from some time, which we're going to get into in future episodes. It's not getting a lot of press coverage. It's not like it would be today. I mean, you look at Texas, for instance, they have an individual they believe is killing people down in a park. That's gotten international attention, even though very few bodies and very few evidence has been released to link the cases together. On January 24th, 2011, the Suffolk County Police announces that they have identified the three other victims who had been discovered in December. The bodies belonging to Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Melissa Barthelme, and Amber Lynn Casillo. Maureen Brainerd Barnes was a 25-year-old woman who lived in Norwich, Connecticut. She disappeared on July 9th of 2007, telling friends and family that she planned to spend the day in New York City. Maureen had worked as a paid sex worker in the past, although at some point she had gotten out of the business and only got back into it when she received an eviction notice from her house as she had not been paying the mortgage, at which point Maureen took to posting her information on Craigslist in an effort to solicit clients. Maureen was a mother of two, and everything I have read has stated that she was a very good woman who had been forced into the current circumstances her life had found her in at the time of her disappearance. One interesting piece of information about Maureen's disappearance, though, comes from a friend of hers by the name of Sarah Carnes, who stated that shortly after Maureen went missing, she received a phone call from a man coming from an unfamiliar number. The man stated that he had seen Maureen at a whorehouse in Queens. This friend demanded to know the location of this quote-unquote whorehouse in Queens, as well as who the man was. The man refused to identify himself, but did promise to call back with information as to where Maureen was, although unfortunately she never received another phone call. Maureen was described as petite, 4 foot 11 inches tall, and 105 pounds. She had been strangled. Melissa Barthelme, aged 24, of Erie County, New York, had been living in the Bronx and working as an escort through Craigslist when she went missing on July 12, 2009. As with the other victims, Melissa was 4 foot 10 inches tall, 95 pounds. She too had been strangled to death. Now, interesting with Melissa's disappearance, on the night that she vanished, she had told friends that she was going out with a client that evening and in fact deposited $900 in her bank account, after which she attempted to reach her boyfriend on the cell phone. Starting roughly a week after Melissa went missing, her younger sister Amanda started receiving phone calls from a male caller, and they've been described as, quote, vulgar, mocking, and insulting. And eventually, the man would inform Amanda that her sister was dead and that he was, in fact, going to watch her rot. When the police looked into this, they found that all of the calls were coming from Melissa's cell phone and had been coming from Midtown Manhattan, Massapequa, and Madison Square Garden. Amber Lynn Costello was 27 years old when she went missing. As with the other victims, she was 4 foot 11 inches tall and weighed roughly 100 pounds. She too had been strangled. Amber was from West Babylon, New York, which is roughly 10 or so miles from the area where her body was found. Many different websites state that she had a pretty serious heroin addiction and had been working as a prostitute through websites such as Backpage and Craigslist in an effort to help fund her habit. Now, she went missing on September 2nd, 2010, so not too terribly long before her body was discovered. On the night that Amber went missing, it's been stated that an unknown number had attempted to call her numerous times, offering her $1,500 for her service. Her family believed that at the time of her disappearance, Amber had in fact been in a rehab center, which is the reason given for not initially listing her as being a missing person. Unfortunately, I don't believe she was in a rehab at this point in time. She may have been talking about going to it. It's known that prior to going to New York, Amber had been living in Clearwater, Florida with her second husband and working as a waitress. She had a history of drug abuse and unfortunately had been sexually assaulted by a neighbor when she was 6 years old. We are going to leave the case here for the time being. They've got 4 bodies discovered now. There's another young woman who is missing, which has led to the discovery of these 4 bodies, but the case is far from over, and the police are going to begin to redouble their efforts in an effort to find out what is going on. Until next week, I hope you enjoyed the first of the Gilgo Beach Slayings series. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Till next time. Stay morbid.